Hello. On this episode of the People Stack podcast, I interviewed Mark Prine. So Mark is actually a former student of mine. He got his master's degree at Westchester University when I was an associate professor there. He then went on to get his PhD and started his own consulting firm. So he is an IO psychologist who works with his own advisory firm called MIP Consulting. So basically what he does is he works with lots of different clients, lots of different business leaders on a variety of different topics, and coaches them and helps them and consults with them, including topics like building trust and helping people through mergers and acquisitions and also hiring, firing, turnover. We covered a variety of different topics that as technical leaders you are going to find extremely valuable, including the ever-present, ever-important topic of building trust among team members. And the jumping off point for that was we talked about employee monitoring tools, the good, the bad, and the ugly of employee monitoring, and how really, when used well, they can actually be useful, but when used poorly, they absolutely destroy trust. We talked about building trust. We talked about hiring. What is the best way to hire team members? And how to do that in a systematic way to make the best predictions possible in terms of who's going to perform the best and who's going to be the best fit culturally for your team, for your organization. And we also turned it around. How can we apply the best practices, the evidence-based, science-backed best practices of hiring from the IO psychology literature, scientific literature, turn that around, peek behind the curtain and say, ooh, how can I apply this if I'm on the job market? We also talked about firing and how to do that with dignity. And Mark talked about his no asshole rule in building his dream career. So it was a fun conversation, and I know that you are going to find it valuable. Enjoy. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, folks. So we have Mark Prine with us here on the People Stack podcast. Mark is an IO psychologist with the management advisory firm MIP Consulting. Welcome, Mark. Great to have you back.
Great to see you. Great to be back. Been a while.
I'm looking forward to speaking out about many things, IO psychology and management consulting and anything else that anywhere else where this this conversation brings us. So before we go there, why don't you go ahead, describe a little bit for folks who are listening, what it is that you do and how you're spending your time these days work-wise.
Yeah, sure. So MIP Consulting is a firm that I started about 5.5 years ago. MIP standing for Management Integrating Psychology. And the whole premise behind what I do is look to take empirical research and data, statistics and data science, psychology and the backing there and put it all together to provide really good management consulting services. So what that tends to look like is who's the best person to hire, succession planning, we have a turnover problem, figure out what's wrong and fix it. How do we use evidence-based practices to really drive success in the workplace, right? I think that for all too long, people made too many gut intuition decisions around a lot of the most important things and decisions that they make in their business. And just as marketing and finance have been really overwhelmed by data in the last few decades, it's really nice to see human capital management coming along that way as well. And while you know just as well as I do, you know, IO psychology and this kind of practice has been around for a long time. The traction that it's gotten in the last 10 years is kind of incredible.
Yeah, it's awesome to see. So much to unpack there around hiring and turnover and the role of intuition. So we'll get there, but actually where I want to start, which was the reason that I reached out to you, I was like, hey, I got to reach out to Mark. It's been a while since we've chatted. Was the quote in that Wall Street Journal article that you provided. It's talking about employee monitoring tools. And I have to say, I was like, wow, those things are still around. First of all, like, really, Big Brother really is still watching? And I loved your quote, which was basically that these tools offer data, but they don't replace good management practices. And some of this tech can be overly obtrusive. So unfortunately, in the Wall Street Journal article, it didn't really go in more than that. But I was like, oh, cool. What a fun quote to unpack. So let's start with this. The article mentions that I believe it was something like one in three of the bigger companies use some kind of monitoring tools. That was just like a holy cow moment for me. I'm like, oh, wow. You know, people still use those kinds of things, even though, you know, they can have some value, but they can be, as you so rightly said, overly obtrusive. So what's your experience with these monitoring tools? And in your opinion, are they good, bad, ugly, or otherwise?
Yeah, so one thing that would probably surprise and disappoint you is how popular they've gotten over the last few years, especially in the wake of the pandemic. You're seeing some of these types of tools leave the Fortune 500 and trickle down into more small, mid-sized businesses. I do a ton of work. My primary clients have been private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, where I'm doing a lot of work with them on due diligence, right? They know that they're betting on the jockey as much as they're betting on the horse. And so I'm doing a lot of management assessment and things up front. And when I'm assessing and doing some of these culture type interviews around the organization to learn where the mistrust is, a lot of the times there's some kind of technology that's being used. There's something that's happening where they think that they're measuring employee engagement, but what they're really measuring is keystrokes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And they're looking to find out people feel in sheep's clothing, right? In a lot of these cases where there's the tools that are built for particular purposes and just being completely misused by the micromanager who doesn't know how to use data the right way. Those are some of the ways that I'm really seeing it happen, where the tool has a good intention. There's either something to do with, you know, how long that green light is on your Microsoft Teams account.
Wow.
Right. Or when does it go yellow? And why does it, and people are monitoring and keeping track with a lot of these things. And there's tools that are letting people know, you know, how many emails are people sending in a day. And it started during COVID where people were a little nervous about, you know, are people working at home?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're seeing a lot of other things in the tech space, but that, I think that really made a lot of people nervous, right? And on one side of it, I think it was the death of the micromanager, which I was pretty happy about because it's really hard to micromanage from a distance. On the other hand, there's all these really easy, cheap tools to use that kind of help you be a micromanager from afar.
Yeah, and I think what I want to highlight in what you shared is not only that they've increased in prevalence, but that it sounds like the intent is either good or neutral. The intent, it feels like the intent behind them is not evil, but it's like, okay, hang on a second. We have a changing workplace now. People are working from home and I can't watch them, right? We get a little bit of that from our clients, but what I would say in our bubble, in the PeopleStack bubble, it's more the questions that might come up around these things are, like, how do I not do this, right? Basically, how do I go rogue and let the team know, like, yeah, it may be tracked and we may be required to do this, but how do I assure them that we still have a trusting relationship here and I'm not literally watching you, you know? And it's almost like my experience of it is almost like a making fun of it, poking fun with it. So can you give another few examples? Because I think for a lot of our listeners, like myself, we're going to be just surprised that it exists, so prevalently, but also like, oh, wow, this is happening in these kinds of ways. So you mentioned like the Microsoft Teams, like essentially it tracks how much they're online, or it might track how many emails they're sending in a day. That's just
exactly there's all these things with timestamps, and mm-hmm. if somebody decides to use those timestamps in the wrong way, right? This is no different than somebody who would get the, you know, when you had a badge and you would go into an office and swipe your badge, you know, from a security perspective, you know, who was in and who was out of the building was always something that could be tracked and you could get a report for it. And this is just a digital way. And what I've really found is people are skeptical of it, and they know when a manager is doing it because they're the only one, right? This is not, from what I've realized a lot, is that the use of these technologies and the use of technology in this way is not as systemic as you might think, right? I'm not talking about somebody implementing a Big Brother tool. I'm talking about somebody, you know, implementing a, you know, generative AI tool that links up with your email. And wow, the CIO always checks who's sending emails at what time of the day.
Okay.
Right. And oh wow, the chief marketing officer is always asking for this report or that report. And so it's not necessarily the intention of the tool, right? You know, the technology isn't bad. It's the way that people are using it sometimes.
Yeah. And what, if you've had the experience with it, what I want to know, what I'm curious about is, what do the CIOs say? So the CIOs who are logging on, or the CMOs or the CTOs, the upper level leaders, who are logging on and saying, okay, this person sent this many emails, or like with our clients a lot, it's like, how many lines of code did this person write? Which is not at all, by the way, an indicator of the quality of what it is. So what I'd like to understand is their perspective. Like, are they doing it begrudgingly? Maybe some of them are, but are there folks who are doing it like, and thinking that this is working and helpful?
Yeah, I think that the difference between quantity and quality of work is going through a little bit of a revolution right now. I think that you're going to start seeing people stop thinking about time-based work and look towards output, right? You can write, you know, I could write 5 lines of code really fast, but you know what? I don't know how to write code, so it's going to be bad, right? And it's going to be useless, right? And so understanding that and knowing that, and when people are using it, a lot of the times it is in a vindictive way, right? It is in a way where people are asking these questions or doing these things to see who's online, who's not online, who can I trust, who can I not trust, when layoffs or other things, you know, come up, right? And they're trying to think, okay, well, let's do this in a data-driven way. You know, are they going to use the smiley face performance metrics that they use, because we know that those aren't good, right? Are they going to use who they like? Well, you know that they might get in trouble for that. So what are the other things that they can do?
Yeah. So from your perspective, from, you know, the mental models that you have and the science that you know, but also from your years of experience in working directly with people, what's the long answer to, you know, I'm not going to cut you off. You don't just get 2 lines. You don't just get 30 seconds, right? What is the long answer to the question, why technology is so bad and so harmful?
Again, depending on the technology, I don't think it's bad or harmful, right? In some cases, and I think that this has been a big, almost culture, socioeconomic, like, you know, there are people who need to be working on site in a place doing something, right? And then there are other people who are usually knowledge workers who necessarily don't need that. And it's really hard when you have a bifurcated workforce to manage with two sets of rules, right? Yeah. I was at PSYOP this year, the Society for IO Psychology conference for those who aren't nerds like the two of us. One of the sessions, there was a guy who was the CHRO for one of the largest convenience store operations across the country. Okay. And one of the things that he talks about, he's like, the person who's working the cash register, they can't work from home, no. Right? But my entire, you know, procurement department can. And so how do I set up these rules for these two different environments and these two different people and make it fair and equitable across? And so that's where these one size fits all approaches end up being implemented. And the people who are, you know, developer that convenience store and working on their website and their online ordering and their other platforms, right? They feel like they're being taken advantage of because there are rules that shouldn't apply to them or maybe don't apply to them in other settings. Mm-hmm. And then other people, and it's this catch 22 of like, how do we do it? How do we do it in a fair way? And, you know, I empathize with those leaders and it was, and, you know, it's a really interesting business case, you know, because the technology isn't bad. And I feel like a lot of times people are going into these relationships with the right intention. And then, you know, you manage to the wrong number. And when you manage to a number, sometimes you get behaviors that only lead to that number.
Yeah.
Right. I'll never forget. Was it? I don't know if it was at Westchester or somebody else. Somebody I knew really well was doing research, and they were doing research with a call center, big major call center, and they were trying to figure out and do these performance metrics within this call center. And one person on the floor was like doubling the productivity of everybody else, and it didn't make sense. And what this person realized was that when you're on the call for 6 seconds, it registers as a call and you get credit and paid based on productivity, not quality. So he would pick up a phone, count to six and hang up, pick up a phone, count to six and hang up, and then maybe actually help a customer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're incentivizing the wrong behavior. Mm-hmm. And it all comes back to the carrot and the stick, right? Like all of these complex mental models that we talk about, we are nothing but carrots and sticks. And you know, if you incentivize the wrong behavior, right? I think regularly of Dr. Duncan's, you know, behavioral engineering model. I have that book and reference it regularly. So those are the things, right? From a previous life.
Yes, yes. There are absolutely things to be learned from a pure behaviorist model where, so look, we're human, there's nuance, there's things like emotion and beliefs that I geek out about a ton. You know, I did when I was in grad school, I did when I was at Westchester, I still do now as a coach. And yet it's like, okay, what gets measured gets managed. So if what's mm-hmm. measured is how long you're on the phone and it only needs to be 6 seconds, then that's all people are going to do, especially mm-hmm. if they see it as a punch in, punch out kind of job where it's like, yeah, I'm here for the paycheck. You know, this isn't my dream job. I'm here to get the work and I'm here to keep this job and have a stable job. And I think mm-hmm. that there's something to be gleaned from that. And I also appreciate that what I hear you saying is that the intent is often good. It's like, how do we incentivize productivity, right? How about we mm-hmm. gamify it, right? And so that can help, but sometimes it can hurt depending on it. And so I think, so what have you been able to witness or be part of cases where these monitoring tools have been implemented and there was some positive effect because of it.
I don't think that I have, right? A lot of the times I'm part of the acquiring organization and I'm doing diligence and I'm learning about all of these things and they're being bought. And one of the ways that the acquiring organization has looked to actually gain trust in some of the workforce is saying like, hey, we're going to stop using this.
Uh-huh.
Right. And you know, and like what's actually funny is like the ones where people are skeptical and they think that they're being monitored when they're really not, or that I know of, right? And I think that I think like that's the thing that people feel the most kind of upset about, right? There's this whole social contract stuff, right? When you're in an interview, whether you know it or not, you're signing a social contract, right? I'm going to give you this work. You're going to give me that work. This is what we're going to do, right? To go back to the Mad Men, that's what the money's for, right? Kind of, you know, side of things, right? There's this, whether it's in writing or not, there's this kind of contract that's being built between an employer and employee. And it's this whole piece of when that gets broken and people feel start feeling skeptical about the intentions of the organization, that's when psychological safety is going to go down. That's when performance is going to go down. So unfortunately, I have not been in situations where I've been part of the implementation or the use of these things. I've only seen them as like, oh, wow, this is low-hanging fruit from the investor that we're going to get rid of this.
Yeah.
And people are going to love it. And we're going to be the heroes now, right? Because that's always going to be one of the things that people are most skeptical about is new people buying the company. Right.
Yeah. And I think that speaks to intent too. It's like, okay, we thought that this was going to be helpful, but everybody's skeptical about it. And it's actually lowering performance when it was supposed to raise performance. And it's also lowering other things like engagement and psychological safety, whether they know that through, you know, quantitative means or just like people talking about it. It's like, okay, cool. Good on you then. Right. Good on you for recognizing that you don't need these tools in order to build trust. Mm-hmm. You don't need these tools in order to know. Even when we're talking about, you know, the line workers, you know, the folks who are the individual contributors, there are other ways to monitor their performance. There are other ways to build that trust. And gosh, trust is a big thing. Go for it. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's so hard because how many of the people who you work with, you know, they have these tools that monitor tickets. And how many tickets come in and who gets them and how long it's open. And there are all of these metrics, right? How many HR people are monitored by, how long does it take to fill a job? How many, you know, turnover in 90 days? Like there are all of these little things that are well intent, but they could easily get used the wrong way.
Yeah.
And you could easily start incentivizing that poor behavior. And sorry, I cut you off on trust.
No, you're good. Cause that's where exactly I wanted to go was because this does a lot. It leads back to trust. And so one of the questions that we get a lot from clients, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is how do I build trust? Like, how do I build a genuine trust with my team, an authentic trust? So what has been your experience with that?
Yeah. So whenever I get like a question like that, right, my whole kind of thought and question back to the client, whether I'm coaching them, whether I'm assessing them, whether whatever it is how do you build trust with other people, right? How do you do it outside of work? And the whole point of me bringing this up is all about not being disingenuous, right? We all too often, whether it's trust, whether it's, you know, holding people accountable, whether it's, you know, driving performance in other people, all of these leadership behaviors, right? Especially as you transition from the individual contributor to the frontline manager or the manager to the, you know, unit leader, executive, right? We have these ideas of what a leader should be. And all too often, it's this caricature of a lot of other people that we've seen before. And very little of it is actually us and who we are, right? And so there's this disingenuous approach to leadership, right? Well, I usually joke with clients where I was like, I equate it to like when I was 7 years old and when put on my dad's sport coat, right? Like you're pretending to be another person, and it comes off as fake. And people and like if people know you well enough, it's completely, you can see right through it, right? And so the question that I ask with all of these things is, how do you accomplish things in a genuine and authentic way, right? That's where I'm a big proponent of using psychometric testing, right? And saying, okay, well, you know, here's a Hogan, right? Here is how you're going to approach things. Here's how you're going to react under stress. Here's what your key motivators are, okay? What are the ways that you can use your strength and your best approach in order to be successful, right? I was working recently with a CTO, actually CIO, CTO, however you want to, you know, head of technology, and incredible individual, brilliant, really needed work on executive presence, right? I'm sure not something uncommon from what you deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear how you usually deal with this, but what I did was, you know, we gave him a Hogan and a few other assessments, found his style. I was like, okay, you have incredibly high intellectual curiosity, right? If you were to walk into that room and start yelling and screaming and putting in your opinions, that wouldn't work, okay? But you're really high adjustment, you know, or humility, you're really high in curiosity, you know, let's use Edgar Schein's humble inquiry approach to things and say, instead of inserting your ideas by saying something, you could insert them by asking. And what questions could you be asking in that room to then gain that credibility and start to insert your opinion, right? Yeah. And start there as you get more comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you mentioned this was about executive functioning. Define that for us, because I think even for me, I'm like, ooh, that can be defined in different ways. So what would be the outcome here with this particular individual? So, what do we want to get them to do?
So this was executive presence is what
executive
I meant.
Executive presence, sorry. Got it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so even there, what would be, so explain that in a different way. Like how do you know when someone has executive presence?
Yeah, the person with high executive presence is the person who can own the room, right? The person who can walk in the room, right? It's really easy when we're within our silo, right? If you're always within a group of other, you know, IT tech people, they all speak your language, right? But when you're in that cross-functional room and you've got somebody from finance and somebody from marketing and somebody from operations and somebody from HR, and you need to insert the tech point of view, how can you own that room so that they understand? So
yeah.
I'm assuming that that's something you see a lot.
You were breaking up just a little bit there, but I think we captured it around what executive presence is. And for us, you know, I have to admit, I've been detached is probably the best word from the IO psychology literature, from the science of it. Although like every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, this is cool. What's going on? And so I'd say basically what we call it with our clients is being a badass or like confidence. Like that's often how it shows up with our clients, where it's like, I don't have confidence. Help me with my confidence, Jen. Okay, tell me a little bit more. Describe a situation for me where you want to feel more confident. And it's exactly what you just described most of the time. Where it's like, yeah, you know, with my team, it's fine. And one-on-ones, it's fine. Maybe there's stuff to dial in. But when I walk in, when I talk to the CEO, when I talk to the CTO, or when I walk into a room and there's like somebody from marketing, somebody from sales, I just feel like I have no idea what to say and I can't speak their language. They're either so far above me or so different from me that I can't own the room. You know, and so what's interesting about that, I'd love to chat a little bit more about the psychometric testing piece of it. That's not something that we do a ton of. Occasionally, we will have folks take, you know, maybe a personality assessment, maybe something like that, or maybe they've taken it before, but actually is more common where either through work or just through leisure, they've taken some kind of assessment before. and they may be aware of what their values are, what their, you know, behavioral styles are, what their personality is. And so with us, it's basically the same thing. It's like, who are you? Who do mm-hmm. you want to be as a leader? There's no book that you can read that says, here's how to be a great leader. And if it tries to pretend, walk far away. It's mostly about how do I let my natural values, my natural behavioral tendencies, my natural personality shine. And so what I think is really fun about this is even though we're taking different approaches here, the outcome is the same. It's essentially be you at work. So there's things that you already do that are really awesome. Let's highlight that. And it's almost like giving people a permission slip to be themselves at work. And I love the idea of using psychometric testing for this, because for a lot of people, it's like, well, I don't know what my values are. Can you just give me a bunch of questions to answer that tell me what they are? Yeah, cool. That's great. So you mentioned some tests. I'm not sure that all of our listeners are going to be familiar with Hogan, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So can you give us the sort of, you know, psychometric testing 101 from the perspective of like, what would you tell leaders, you know, like maybe some leaders want to go and take these tests, or maybe they want to work with HR to have them implemented across the team or something like that. Are there tests that are better or worse? Like what might be some best practices that you would encourage people to be aware of, and maybe even some warnings to be aware of? I know that there's some really bad tests out there.
I mean, very similar to really what we spoke about earlier when it comes to some of the monitoring tools. A one size fits all approach to assessment is the wrong way to go. Right. The first thing when I'm working with clients, right, whether it's a new acquisition and I'm doing a due diligence assessment, whether a client's hiring somebody and I'm doing an assessment, you know, for selection and helping them identify who's the right person, whether it's a development assessment and they're saying, hey, I want you to be part of this person's development planning and things like that. The first thing I always say is, okay, what do we want to measure? Right. Because there are so many great tools and they measure very different things. Right. And so the first thing that I always do is build kind of a competency model or framework around what it is that we want to measure. Right. You know, if it's for diligence for a private equity or venture firm, I'm saying, okay, well, what's your investment thesis in this company? Let's understand, what do you need leaders to do in order to accomplish that? Right. If it's a new, you know, director level hire, I'm understanding, okay, well, what's this person's roles and responsibilities and how are they going to need to operate, right? What are the types of people they need to influence? What are the types of ways they need to hold people accountable? What are the types of decisions they need to make? And then from there, I'm curating a battery of assessments, right? I don't have like a tried and true way that I always use it, right? Sometimes I'll use, you know, there are some things that are non-negotiables for me, the two big one are, you know, reliability and validity, right? We want to make sure that it measures what it is you want to measure. You know, there are some tests out there, right, that are going to tell you what color your parachute is, or give you, you know, put you in one of 16 boxes. And I equate those, that's your blood pressure, right? Those tests are going to tell you, how do you feel in this day, right? Some of the more robust assessments that are a little bit longer, a little bit deeper, that's going to be your DNA. Right? Those things don't change really at all. So I'm gonna put a story out there, and this is the kind of nerd that I am about this stuff. Cool. Okay. So whenever I'm like testing out some of these assessments, my wife loves to take them. She takes them for me. And like, you know, I have a list of all the tests that she's taken, right? If you look through all my different accounts, right? For one of them, I hear them use that. I got the DNA line from a training that I went to from one of the vendors, and they say about how they're your DNA kind of thing. And so I wanted to see how true it was. And so 2 years ago, when we had our second daughter, about like 3 or 4 weeks postpartum, I had my wife take the assessment again. I asked her to take the assessment, and I'm like, if there's ever a time where the data is different, right? She, you know, it's 3 weeks without sleeping, you know, hormonal as hell, right? They're all of the body, all the physiological things that are happening, right? Every one of her, like 140 results come out on this assessment.
Yeah.
Everything was within 5 percentage points.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so like, I maybe that might've been a suicide mission for me to ask her to do that. But it sounds like
she loves taking tests. I'm like that too. It's like, oh, you know, another personality test. Cool. I can be, I'll be the guinea pig.
So yeah, no, she loves it.
How do we get, so I was going to say, how can non-IO psychologists get access to these kinds of things? Or would you even recommend that? Because I love the DNA versus blood pressure thing, because it's like, you know, we can take our blood pressure. Somebody can teach you how to take your blood pressure and you can learn how to do it. But like a DNA test, like is somebody who's not aware of it and has expertise in this area, like what are all these numbers mean, right? So is that a reason why there may be a walled garden behind some of these things, and they may actually be feel exorbitantly expensive and difficult to either get access to or administer and then take a look at the results and analyze them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of the things that you see in the news about like people misusing personality assessments, it's usually because somebody just picked up a piece of paper that had lines and bars and tried to interpret it on their own. Right. I think, you know, there is a reason that there, you know, we went through some extensive training so that we understand how these things work and, you know, what are things that actually matter versus don't matter. And, you know, what's bad sometimes is these tests will use psychometric language. Right. And when we talk about something like a basic psychometric language, right, you say the word average, and on a test, that means you're in the middle of the bell curve, you're solid. To a manager, you're like, I'm not hiring somebody who's average.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so that's where some assessments do have like reporting that is meant to be read by a frontline manager type person. And this is where I think the, you know, Myers-Briggs, DISC, all of those kind of bad assessments, and I'll say that they're bad assessments, that they don't, you know, the blood pressure assessments, they make it really easy to interpret because they use this broad flowery language, and and that's where people get in trouble.
Yeah.
So, that's a long way of saying like,
You read my mind, because I was going to say, oh, should I ask Mark about Myers-Briggs and the DISC? Should we go there? So let's go there. What I was going to ask is, you know, we could talk about that, but are you willing to recommend freely available or low cost assessments that might be available online that an individual can take that might offer some insight into something, you know, whether it's their behavioral patterns, their personality, their values. And of course, you know, we need to talk about Myers-Briggs and DISC, because they're all over the place online when you
yeah,
search.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So there's some really interesting ones, right? There's an open source assessment called the IPIP-NEO, right? IPIP-NEO, right? And that is just a good 5-factor personality type assessment. And
yeah, that's
you
the big
can
five,
take that,
right?
That
so
is, that's
ocean,
the big
openness
five.
To experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. And
exactly.
that's like the, how would you call it? Like that would be like, there is, it's evidence-based psychology, right? That's an evidence-based way of measuring personality is the big five.
Exactly. And any one of the assessments that are worth their weight in salt is going to be based on 5-factor personality and that kind of ocean model that you just ran through, right? They are going to use their own proprietary terminology, and they're going to measure it in different ways, right? But basically, right, there's one assessment that I use a lot that takes those 5 factors that you just mentioned and measures 140 different components of personality, all relating back to those 5 factors. Right. But the IPIP-NEO, I believe it's still open source. I believe that you can take it online. I don't know what the output looks like, if it's easy to interpret or not. But okay. That's one. I would say that should be the question that you always ask is like, is this based on five factor, right? Carl Jung, you know, Myers-Briggs, DISC, all based on Carl Jung's typology theory. Carl Jung is the first person to say every person's the exception to the rule. Don't follow this, right? Myers-Briggs was written by two novelists, I believe. That's where I believe that's the history of that assessment.
I'm not sure.
Even on the Myers-Briggs official website, it says do not use this for personnel selection or development or decisions.
Yes.
Right? Like,
look, and I think you may have even talked about this on our last podcast, which was like years and years and years ago. But it's like, look, I actually do think that there is a time and a place for things like, again, I love referring to them as the blood pressure, right? Because it's like, at this point in time, if I want to get a freely available, maybe it's not science backed, but you know what? This isn't about science. I just want to learn about me and I want to have some fun. It's for pure entertainment purposes only.
Yeah.
Like, I actually love Myers-Briggs for that, right? Like, I'm an INFJ, right? And this is not something that I'm going to use like in like my coaching or in like a professional manner. It's more just like for my own awareness and fun, really. The same thing with the DISC. People will talk about the DISC and how it's wonderful. And I know that people use the DISC, you know, particularly in like hiring for sales roles. Like one of my mentors is in sales. And for the longest time that he used the DISC to hire salespeople, because people who are high D, you know, like the dominant drive, tend to do well in sales, or at least this is what he said. I talked to him recently. I was like, I don't remember, you know, what made it come up, but it came up and it was like, hey, are you guys still using the DISC? Or I thought maybe you were using the Big Five. He's like, no, we don't use the DISC anymore. It's all about the Big Five. I'm like, cool, awesome. Because that's about like predicting performance as opposed to for fun and games. I think that DISC and Myers-Briggs are great for fun and games.
Yeah, the problem is when they're fun and games and you say, okay, we're going to do this as a team development thing. And the manager keeps it in their top drawer. And when they're handing out assignments on who should get the next opportunity, they say, oh, Jen's an I. I'm not going to put, I'm Jen, she's not right for that role.
Yeah.
Right. Where it could actually, exactly. Yeah. And that's the problem, right? It's all the misuse of data. It all comes back to the misuse of data.
Yeah. There's no bad data. There's simply misused data. That's I think a really, really important distinction. Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, Coverage Cat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the People Stack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at Coverage Cat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, Coverage Cat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal tech leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be. So we love how Coverage Cat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com. So let's change topics and let's talk about hiring and firing. Because if there's two topics besides how do I build more confidence, that our clients ask about, and I know the podcast listeners would be interested to hear about, is hiring and firing. Because mm-hmm. if ever there were two harder things for any leader, any manager to do, is who do I hire and when do I fire? So let's start from the hiring end of things. What kind of challenges do you see people having? And let's just say, what do you find yourself repeating to clients over and over again that they don't know about hiring?
Yeah. So one thing about hiring is making sure that you're not making a decision based on one data point, right? Whether, you know, what I always say is like, let's establish the criteria for performance, right? What's important? What do you need? You know, a lot of the times you get people who get enamored by the logos that somebody has on their resume. Oh, they were a developer here. Of course they could run architecture there, right? Like, of course. Well, those two things are really, really different, right? If you're trying to hire somebody into your, you know, 40 person startup to run your architecture for your platform, and you're taking them out of IBM or Deloitte because, wow, they have all the hands on keyboard, same skills, right? They know how to code in all the same languages they need. They have all the right ideas. They helped Nabisco do this. And, you know, that's what they did when they were working with Deloitte. That's incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But can they handle not having all the resources of that large organization? Right. And that's where, coming back to what I mentioned earlier, the idea of the competency model, I think, is really important, right? What are the hard skills that you need, right? Those knowledge, those skills, those experiences, the education, whatever, right? But then how do they need to do it, right? How do they need to come to the table? Are they going to be the person who has never necessarily had to influence somebody who's not in technology, and all of a sudden you're going to ask them to be influencing the chief marketing officer on what to do, right? That. Mm-hmm. And then can they translate, right? Can they do that translation? So that's kind of the first step that I always say is like, figure out all of those other things. And then what are the different ways that we can measure that, right? What are the best interview questions that we can do? What are the best assessments that we can put people through? Especially in the technology space, you love a role play. You love an inbox assessment, what I would call an inbox assessment. You, right? Yeah. Those types of hands-on things. Okay, well, what can we create in an equitable way, right? Because this is where a lot of the DEI and adverse impact things play a role, is how we put people through those processes. Because, you know, when we give somebody code and we give them a week to work on a presentation or do some coding, of course the person who's 23 single male is going to do better on that because they've have all the time in the world compared to the single mother.
Yeah.
And so who are you not even, who are you going to disenfranchise from the start, right? So in all of those cases, I usually say like, give people, you know, they're already taking a day off of work to come in for the interview, mm-hmm. you know, have them spend the hour and give them the entire exercise right there. So you see what does everybody produce in that hour?
Yeah.
So yeah. That's just kind of a little bit about it, right? I'm a huge proponent of helping my clients identify like kind of just structured interview process, right? You know, mm-hmm. there are two types of interviews, and I don't know how deep you want me to go here, but, you know, the unstructured interview, right? That casual conversation, that tell me about yourself, walk me through your resume, right? Research shows that predicts performance about 20% of the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have clear criteria for what you're looking for, if you have questions that are focused on, you know, sussing out information about those criteria, if you've got ways to evaluate those candidates and you kind of put every candidate through a similar process, that improves the predictability to over 65-70%, right? Yeah. And so you're just adding predictability, right? The goal of hiring is to predict performance, nothing yeah. else.
Yeah.
And making sure that is the thought. What arrows are you using to shoot at the target?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great reminder that the role of hiring is to predict performance, because I think as obvious as that is after we say it, I think so many people do the, whatever you want to call it, entirely intuition-based, this person just rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know if they're going to do good, or yeah, I went to a bar and had drinks with this person and we chatted, you know what? We mostly just talked about sports the whole time. This person's going to do great. Yeah. And so this is also what happens a lot. And we see this because we have a lot of our clients are moving from like upper middle level management to higher level management, higher level leadership, you know, like a VP to a CTO kind of a situation, or a manager to a VP kind of a situation, where some or a lot, depending on the organization, especially if it's a smaller organization, interview process is entirely unstructured and often like off campus. Like, in other words, let's meet for drinks and let's chat. And so I love your take on this, because I wonder what role you believe intuition plays here, because while performance is important, isn't it also important that this person like fit in with the team, you know, what we might call culture fit? And going out to drinks with someone, although there's just a whole bunch of red flags for doing that. It's like, yes, you can have iced tea, but can that person, you know, is that person a single mom, et cetera, et cetera. But might having that person, you know, come in and involve and get involved a little bit more informally, you know, like a 3-day interview process where one of the things that they do is there's just like an after work mocktails party or whatever it is that you want to do. And you see how they're acting. This is how academics are hired, by the way, right? We go through, bring us through the ringer, and it's like, okay, is this person going to fit in? So I'm curious what role you believe, again, intuition plays, and also culture fit.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of culture is something that's completely misconstrued by especially the tech sector, right? You think about culture, and all too often people think about, you know, ping pong tables and beer kegs and we wear jeans on Friday, right? That's not culture, right? Culture, as it's defined in academia, are shared behaviors and approaches to doing things, right? How do a group of people hold each other accountable? How do a group of people make decisions? What leadership style does and does not work within our environment, right? That's the culture of your organization, right? Can I sit at the airport bar for 4 hours with this person, right? The only thing that you're going to predict there is that you're going to end up with a lot of white dudes in a room together.
Yeah.
Right there. And that's, you know, so when you identify culture and you talk about what are the things that you're looking to do from a cultural way and how are people going to fit in? See, you know, when they get in a scrum, right, and they're kind of arguing back and forth with somebody about an idea, how do they show up in that conversation, you know, in the boardroom? Because if that goes poorly, then nobody's going to want to get drinks afterwards.
Yeah. Excellent point. So what I hear you saying is drinks after work may be a less valid predictor of performance and culture fit than some kind of like assessment or inbox test or something that has them put in to a realistic job preview where it's like, okay, do it. You know what I mean? Like, hey, go talk to the CMO. And you know, some kind of structured assessment that's designed to assess exactly the competencies that we're looking for and exactly the behaviors and the values that we want to espouse in this organization.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that I develop a lot of are called situational judgment questions and tests. So, like, how do you actually create those more case-based conversations? Right. You know, you ask a candidate, you walk into a room. The CMO says this, what are you most likely to do? What are you least likely to do? Right. Here are some options. Let's see where you go. And what does your gut intuition say? And then you ask questions and you go down and you really see like, okay, well, would that approach work here? Yeah. Yeah. That would work here. That would be a great way to handle our marketing team. That'd be a great way to handle the operations team.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So these are the if then kinds of questions. If this were to happen, what would you do kinds of questions, situational judgment.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something, and what I always say is think about this process and put it all together before you've ever even considered a candidate.
Oh yeah.
Right. Because all too often, right. They design don't design the interview process around the person. Design, you know, see if the person fits what you need them to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have some of those informal things, right, if you want to have some of those conversations where you're getting to know them, I mean, just know what kind of bias you're letting into the process. Right. And be aware of it. And if, you know, have the open conversation of, hey, this person rubs me the wrong way. Does anybody know why? Of the other people who've met with this person. Right.
That's such a good point. Yeah, to have one person say, this person said something that rubbed me the wrong way, but to have five other people say, seem great to me, you know? And so like have a conversation around it, but your point is so well taken that it's designed, that this really does need to be custom tailored for that role, for that organization. What are the competencies of the role? What are the knowledge, skills, abilities, other kinds of characteristics that that person needs to have in order to do well in that job and to fit in, if that's what an outcome that you want to as well, and then design design the process around that, as opposed to what we also often see. You know, we definitely see too. I've heard tell because clients talk about it. Yeah, where it's just like, oh, there's this person that's here, and so I'm going to ask them this question, where that's such a great example where the question is designed around the person in front of you instead of the question being designed around the overall outcome. What often happens too that we hear of is like, look, these questions get around. People go on enough interviews that it's like, oh man, I got asked this during an interview and I got asked this during an interview. So then people who don't want to pay for the IO psychologist or, you know, somebody who's an expert in assessment to come in and do it, or at least take the time to do it themselves, is like, you know what? I'm just going to copy paste. I'm just going to change a few words. And then our clients are like scratching their heads and they're saying, why did you ask me that? That seems perfectly irrelevant to the job. And our clients will say that. They'll be like, yes, please say that. I have no idea why you're asking me. I'm genuinely curious why that's relevant to this job. And you call them out. Like, that's executive presence right there. That's who you want to hire. That's what you're measuring for.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, going back to the cultural fit piece of it, when you know, you're making a sale about, you know, you're making a, it's this two-way sale, right? The company is looking to sell, hey, you want to work here, especially in this job market, right? With 3% unemployment. And the candidate's saying, you should want to hire me. I'm the best person for the job, right? And so there's this incredible dance that happens where people, you know, say what they want, what they think they want the other person to hear, and not what they actually mean and want to say. But if you have a good structured approach, right? Like think about those situational questions that I just mentioned, right? If I throw five of those out at you, you're probably thinking, that's what I'm signing up for.
Yeah,
I'm signing up for these kind of problems. I'm signing up to deal with that. I'm signing up. And then you're like, so you're more likely to assess whether or not you're a fit as much as the organization is assessing if you're a fit.
Yeah.
And that's where, right? Like this idea, there's a, one of my favorite findings in all of psychology literature, right? Crazy phenomenal within psychology. If you tell somebody what you expect them to do, they're more likely to do it. Right.
Yeah.
Mind blowing. But how much ambiguity do your clients run up against when they're interviewing?
Yeah.
And they're like,
yeah,
I don't know how many ping pong balls fit in a 747, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Who cares?
Yeah, expectation is so strong. Like, I'm about to tell you something so amazing, Mark. Like, okay, cool, you got my attention. We need to do better at hiring, or whatever it is. And what I also love about this conversation too is that the other side of hiring is interviewing, right? So somebody who wants to get the job. And one of the things that we talk about with our clients all the time is turn the tables, right? Turn the tables. If you've hired before, most of our clients have enough experience that they've hired at least one team member, if not whole teams of people. It's like, turn the tables. If you were hiring for this position, what would you ask? And so then it's kind of like, it's kind of fun because if our clients are going on interviews with people who are using a completely unstructured approach, and then it's like, oh, what questions do you have? It's like, okay, how much time do you have here? You know, it's like, and then they're interviewing them and almost asking them these situational questions. And so that's also a way that you can take a scientific approach to being on the job market too, where it's like, what's my dream job? What's my ideal culture, you know, behaviors and values that I want to live in? And what are the things I want to do on a day-to-day basis? Okay, I'm going to come up with a series of questions for you to find out if it's a great fit. And I really do think that more and more people will be doing that. And honestly, should be doing that, especially at the higher levels, but even if it's not. So you can peek behind the curtain, behind the science here, and be like, all right, if you're not going to use a structured approach, at least I am.
Yeah.
And then we have a better chance of this, of us winning here and determining whether it's a fit.
Yeah. Hopefully one side figures it out and makes the right choice.
Yeah. 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 50-50 shot. Maybe hopefully more than that.
Yeah. And but I do have to say, though, even the IO psychologist is not immune to being human, right? There was the longest interview that I've ever done was because some guy in the middle of the interview started telling me about trying to get a rocket off at NASA. And I was like, all right, let's forget all the competency questions for a minute. I want to zero in here. This is too cool.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like, I want to hear the story once in a lifetime, potentially once in a lifetime opportunity.
Exactly.
That's cool. So we talked about hiring. Let's talk about firing. You know, so you mentioned turnover. So what have been your experiences around turnover, letting people go, best ways to do that? Particularly the questions that, I mean, the question that we get the most from clients is, should I fire this person? And if so, how? I don't want to hurt anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I always, when my clients are going through this, I always say this in an attempt to humble the situation, is that when you have to fire somebody, it's a referendum on a bad management decision, right? It was either a bad management decision of hiring them, it was a bad management decision of how you led them, it was a bad management decision of how you've coached them, or all the things involved, right? This is, this is a management problem at the core of it. And so the question that I always have is, what are the things that you've done to help this person turn around, right? What are the performance expectations? And are you holding other people on your team to the same expectations?
Yeah.
Because that's something that happens a lot.
Yeah.
Is that people will start getting really meticulous about one person and letting the golden child do whatever they want. And that is going to do nothing but breed more mistrust across the organization, right? Are you incentivizing the right behaviors? I did a project, this is years ago now, with a pharmaceutical sales team that had 40% year over year turnover. Okay. Yeah.
And that's high, by the way, that, right?
Yeah. I think like 20 might be the industry average, maybe, yeah. But 40 is pretty high, right? And so I sat in on their interviews, and their interviews were great. They asked questions that were targeted about the culture, about what they do, about what they care about. First interview question was all about teamwork and collaboration, because that has to be everybody's core value, right? For some reason, every company needs to have teamwork and collaboration as one of their core values. I did a ride along with their top performing rep. It was the most independent job in the world. They didn't work with anybody. They didn't collaborate with anybody. They hired the wrong people. Like in a lot of cases, they hired the wrong people, because the first interview question was all about collaboration, and they weeded out all the people who were bad collaborators. And yeah. like that's where I kind of talk about, are you measuring the right thing, right? Are the performance metrics actually aligned with how the job is going to be? And that person just happened to, be a great performer with, while still being able to be collaborative, or at least tell a good story in an interview.
And
so that was, so some of those things are things that I always like to ask about. Right. And then my last question is really, when you think about the person, right, is it the job? Is it the role? Is it the task? Or is it the organization? Right. Do you have an accounting of the Peter principle, where somebody just got promoted to a level above their competence? They were an incredible individual contributor. You promoted them to manager, which was a bad management decision, and they're a bad manager. You know, so do you have the opportunity to make them an individual contributor again?
Yeah.
Right. Is that the right move for you? Have you given them a coach, developmental assignments, right? Are you giving them peer learning? Is there other things that you're doing to invest in them on it and making sure that they're getting that kind of support, right? Mm-hmm. There's like a number of different ways and you know, things I usually do when I ask the question. Okay. You know, not surprisingly, I always like to use a psychometric assessment there sometimes to understand maybe are they trying, you know, sometimes a manager says you have to do it this way. And that person is not the right, the INTJ or whatever it is being asked to be the opposite. And so they're burning out and they're not doing a good job of it. And so, okay, well, let's coach this person towards their actual personality and to do it the way that maybe is a more authentic way.
Yeah. And then you would go up from there. But so maybe you have done all of these things and maybe it's an organization problem.
Yeah. And so then at that point, right, you know, it's with dignity, right? And it's making sure, right, what kind of, you know, are you going to give them some kind of outplacement services? Are you going to think about the other decisions that you're going to make? And, you know, I've had, especially with some of the private equity organizations that I've done work with, where I'm assessing the leadership team, and it's really clear, right? This person grew the company to $100 million. They're not going to be the people who grow it to 500 million. Mm. And we know at some point we're going to need to make that change. Right. You know, I did one about a year ago now where it was a brilliant kind of technology focused CEO. Incredible. Right. Product wise, brilliant, understood the customer, just awful operations management, executive leadership, a lot of those things. All he wanted to do was be working with the team, writing code, fixing the problem, right? And I'm sure you see this a lot. And so we put them through an assessment in the team, and it was part of the diligence for my client who was an investor. And they said, they're like, you know, after the debrief, they're like, you know, I debriefed them and I was like, he's not going to get it to 500 million where you want it to go. He's not going to be able to carry out this investment thesis, but he would be the best chief technology officer, CIO, that you could ever have or ever want. And so then it came down to having a conversation with him of, you know, are you humble enough to just work on the things that you want to work on? Yeah. You know, and I used a, you know, a bad line of, you know, would you rather have, you know, 80% of a grape or 40% of a watermelon? You know, and yeah. You know, do you want to grow this to where it can go and bring in somebody, put them on top of you, right? We kept his title as CEO, brought in somebody as the president, who was really the CEO, and the sure. CEO's only charge was to run the technology, and the president ran the rest of the business.
Perfect. I love that example because it shows how that there's a dance here, there's an interplay. It's like, okay, cool, this is what the assessment showed. Here's what we need as an organization. And then from the individual's perspective is here's what I want, right? Because there's also scenarios where somebody might say, yeah, actually, I may not be good at this right now, but I want to get great at it. Like, I actually do want to be the true CEO. I don't want to just stay with the team. And I know that it's going to, maybe even I'll have a bit of an existential crisis, which often happens, where it's like, you mean I can't be in the tech every day? Yeah, but you know what? I'm willing to do that because I want to grow and that's how I want to grow. Yeah. So if somebody's saying that, it's like, okay, then that's a different conversation around training and development and coaching to get that person prepared to shift their roles.
And that's where the assessment is not just a diagnostic, but then also kind of what comes next, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just used to make a decision, but then all of the recommendations that come of what are the things that you can do to get the team from A to B? What are the changes that you could make, right? Making sure that when you're assessing somebody, you're assessing their DNA and not just their blood pressure, so that you can see, maybe they've never done this before, but with the right coaching, they can.
Yeah.
Right. So another great example, I'm doing an assessment for an insurance company. My client's buying this kind of insurance type of play. They had an incredible controller, right? Who they called their CFO, right? The CEO really liked their 24-year-old KPMG auditor. And so he hired him to be their CFO, right? He did incredible job of putting together like the financial back end of the company, right? Everything ran really smoothly. Everything was really efficient. He was doing great. The problem is that this investment was going to be highly acquisitive. They were planning on making 8 to 10 acquisitions over the course of 5 years. They're like, he's never done one acquisition. He can't do that. They were going to boot him and get rid of him. And I put him through the assessment. I was like, he has all the potential in the world. He can be that CFO that you need him to. So instead of firing the CFO and hiring an expensive search firm and going out and finding this seasoned CFO who's done it and spending a lot of money, they brought in somebody who they had worked with in the past to just kind of like hold his hand for the first few acquisitions, right? Yeah. Just side by side, work through it, took off the training wheels. I think they exited at like an 8x multiple, something crazy. Like,
Perfect. Yeah.
And just, right, they were ready to spend all of this money and get rid of this high potential individual just because he didn't have the right line on his resume.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, that happens so much where somebody has the potential that it's in their DNA and they're saying, yes, I want this. And so it's like, okay, cool. How do we get it? How do we get it?
Yep.
Past behavior can predict future behavior. The thing that the asterisk there though is, except when we change our mind, right? If somebody changes their mind and says, actually, I want to go do something different, and I know that I'm perfectly capable of behaving differently, then that's like the underpinnings of behavior change, right?
And or so when I haven't had the opportunity. When I haven't had the opportunity is also a big part of it, right? If you're in this big, highly matrixed organization and you want to go smaller and you want to be on a more nimble team, right? Being able, but it's also preparing yourself and showing what you haven't done, but what you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's change gears. I also want to talk about, we talk about careers here at the People Stack. We're career coaches. We love talking about dream careers and finding out about, you know, how did you become who it is that you became and how much are you enjoying it? And so the question that I have for you is what's really interesting and to me, because like I said, like I my degree is IO psychology, but I've like, it's kind of like on the side. Like I love the fact that I got a degree in IO psychology. I love the fact that I was a professor, associate professor of IO psychology for almost 10 years. I embraced that. And now it's like, okay, well, what's next? Let me branch off and, you know, find out what else there is in the world. And I found coaching and it's just, you know, and it's awesome. For you, what I love is that you are really embracing the IO psychology and the science piece of it. And I saw it in you when, you know, so Mark was my student, by the way, folks. He was one of my master's students when I was teaching at the master's program at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. And I just love how much, like, even more than me, not to like inflate my ego too much, but like you've embraced the IO, you've embraced the science of it. So what is like, why did you decide to do that? What led you to that? And like, what's your favorite part of doing all of that?
Oh man, there's a lot of great questions there. So I appreciate it. And I had a lot of great professors and people like yourself who threw, you know, kerosene on the fire. The first time I ever presented academic research was with you at a conference. So for me, I mean, it really came down to the interest side of things, right? Like I've always liked the numbers and the data piece of it. I was always the kid memorizing the back of baseball cards. and knowing exactly that, you know, what, you know, Bernie Williams hit when he won the batting title in 1996, right? Like that was just always the things that I love to do. And so being able to do it, right? When I went to college as a psychology major, I knew that I didn't want to be like the typical have a couch in your office kind of psychologist. And I was looking at sports psychology, and then I learned about IO solely because it was the only elective that was not at 8:30 in the morning, was the only reason I took an intro to IO class. And like that, and it was like, oh, this is kind of the intersection of data, of psychology, and of business. And I'm like, that's kind of cool. Like, you know, how do you use data inspired by the psychology to improve the business? And that's been kind of my endless pursuit of things and what really interested me, right? I've had this kind of, it seems linear, but kind of zigzag, you know, career, right? I went to a terminal master's program. I worked for a number of years and then was like, you know, went and got my PhD and got really into the analytics and taught statistics and, you know, dove in there a little bit more and kind of came out the other end in a different career path.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Would you consider what you're doing right now to be your dream job?
So I would say yes, because, you know, 5 years ago or 5.5 years ago now, almost six, I started this practice. I went out on my own because it was the third time in my career that I was part of an acquisition and the company had gotten bought. And it was the time in my career where my path to partnership changed and those rules changed. And I was kind of like, okay, well, I'm selling work and I'm doing work. Let me go out on my own and just like figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And I'm right. Like that was really the impetus of kind of doing it. And now I'm kind of like, and I've always been kind of a you know, a work to live type person. Like I work hard when I work, but like getting to pick up my kids from daycare at 4 o'clock and hang out with them for a couple hours before hopping on a call with you. And it's great, right? It's a great way to live. And, you know, getting to have that flexibility at this point in my life, like I can't imagine not having it.
That's awesome.
So I guess for right now, it's my dream career.
Yeah. Yeah. What about not right now? Like how far can you stretch out? Like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? What do you see yourself doing?
I don't know. I don't really have any thoughts. The idea of having a real job and having a boss is kind of scary. A lot of private equity firms have started to build out their kind of like value creation teams. And a lot of them have somebody with an IO background working with them. And so like really getting in deep in with all of the kind of portfolio companies and being really involved, like that could be kind of fun for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I never could see myself being at like a big company again. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun to think about. I concur, by the way, having a boss is scary to me.
Yeah. My bosses are the three ladies upstairs. That's who I answer to.
Exactly. Happy wife, happy life, right? Happy kids too.
Yeah, exactly.
Happy husband, happy wife too. I think it works both ways. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I have considered over the last, it's been like 8 years since I started the People Stack and went off on my own. I'm like, oh, you know, what would it look like if I took a job, like a job, right? And I was like, oh, you know, it would have to look like this. It would have to look like this. Or maybe I would go back to academia. And I'm not writing that off on particularly the academic route. But I always kind of joke where it's like, yeah, you know, maybe I would be a professor again, but I'm never grading ever, ever again. Can't make me grade. happy to give feedback, happy to give guidance, right? But somebody else has to do the grading because I don't believe in it. So
yeah.
Anyway, I think it's fun to sort of play with that because while the truth is we don't know how many more years or decades that we have, I think it's a fun way to be like, all right, well, here's what I might want to be doing 10 years from now. How can I make it so right now? Like, and
yeah.
So for you, like maybe it's about even more flexibility. So it's okay, cool, right? Like, especially when the kids are little and you want more of that. It's like, yeah, game on. Like so many of our clients talk about that too. It's like, yep, I wanna upgrade my career. I wanna earn more money because that's part of it. I wanna make more of an impact, but I'm not sacrificing the flexibility, freedom, balance, tranquility, whatever you want to call it, that's in my life. So it sounds like that's really important for you as well. So it's great to hear.
Yeah, no. And that's the fun part of getting to work on my own, right? I got to a point, you know, where when the client wasn't fun to work with, I can kind of say, I don't want to work with you again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'll introduce you to somebody else. Right. And like, life is too short to deal with assholes. And that's
oh,
really
gosh,
what,
yeah. That's a pull quote right there. It is.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah. We definitely have a no asshole rule here at the People Stack as well. There is a, let's just say there's a vetting process that people need to go through in order to become one of our clients. It's like the opposite of this. Okay, cool. You know, $50 an hour, you know, whatever it is. It's like, no, you have to be serious about it. And it creates, you probably experience this too, especially when you might have multiple clients, even when they're not talking to one another. It just creates this atmosphere of, it makes it feel easier. It's like, yes, I will take the compliments. Yes, I will own my expertise in terms of my role in helping you make this change happen, but like own your role here too, right? Like,
yeah.
you are badass and like, we're not working together because you're not badass. I guess the other way of saying it is like, we're working together, so you're badass. Because I only work with badass people. I don't work with assholes. So it's really fun. And I think it's an important reminder for anyone out there who either wants to start a side gig or does have their own business going on, or even like might be on the job market considering what it is, the work that they want to do. It's like, yeah, no asshole rule. Like filter it out. Like if it's,
yeah.
We were talking about intuition before, right? But it's like if you're interviewing and you're on the job market and somebody says something that's just like, wait, hang on a second. Is this how you treat people around here? Like really treat that as a red flag, because this may be something that maybe a behavior that happens all the time and you don't want to have to work for that kind of person. So I think it's important.
Yeah. I mean, you're potentially spending more time with those people than you are your spouse and kids.
Yeah.
And so think about that.
Yeah.
Right, a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, it's been super fun, Mark. Is there anything else that you want to share in terms of whether it's best practices from the IO psychology world, or in terms of, let me ask this question and then feel free to embellish with whatever you'd like. Well, let's end with this question. If there was a piece of advice that you would give to tech leaders out there, so that they mm-hmm. could not only be the best leaders that they can be, but also just be the best humans that they can be, what would you want to say to them?
I'd say take a step back and think about the person, right? Make sure that the advice or the way that you're leading your team, you're thinking about the unit, but then also the individuals that make up that unit. And so knowing that the message that you give to the entire group maybe needs to be then broken down. And while it makes a little bit more work for you right now, it's an investment in your time.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so if people wanted to find out more about what you do, follow what you're doing, what's the best way to do that online?
Yeah, so LinkedIn, Mark Prine, don't really use many other social media tools or email that you can throw in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that sounds great. Sounds for the best, right? Pick one social media tool and have that be it.
Yeah.
And basically like that too.
Exactly. Keep
All
it simple.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure, Mark.
Yeah, thanks. It was great to catch up and chat.
Yeah, awesome. And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero, and it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs. Aloha and mahalo.